Good morning. I'm going to call this meeting of members. We're going to call this meeting of March 17th, 2026 of State Government Finance and Policy to order. We are going to bypass the minutes. There are some corrections that need to be made. So we are going to trust that those will get done. And first on the agenda is my bill. So I'm going to go to the testifiers table and Representative Davis will take over.
Chair Nash, House File 3682. We're going to be moving this to, referring it to Ways and Means, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So I would move 3682 to come before the committee, and I have an A1 author's amendment to engross, which would extend the implementation date to 2027, if we could move that.
Yeah, any questions on that? No? So moved? I'm sorry, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 3682 as amended would take the principles from the cybersecurity world of vendor risk management and apply them to grant management here at the state of Minnesota. It would work in conjunction with several other efforts that are underway. I know Chair Cleburne has a bill and the Department of Administration and I have spoken. This would work in concert with their pre-grant evaluation and assessment work. The concept of vendor risk management, if you've never heard of it before, is effectively the organization, the parent organization, would set a list of criteria that have to be met in order for something to proceed. In the cybersecurity world, it's how secure are you, what internal practices do you have. For this application, it would be details about what is the recipient organization going to do with the money, what is your internal controls, what are your internal structures and different things like that. It is really designed to apply a numeric score to internal controls and allow the granting organization, for example, if they had 200 items that they felt were necessary things, they could assign a value of a point each. Then they could also say that you must have a score of 150 in order to proceed to the next round. It doesn't necessarily preclude a potential grantee from receiving the grant, but it does give the granting organization some tools to say, you know what, we'd like to have a talk with you. We'd like to look at some potential remediation. We'd like to have you look at some things that you might change in order to elevate your score. And, you know, members, we've talked a lot about fraud that has happened. This is really a bill designed to look at preventing fraud in the future by applying some controls up front and saying if we do the tenets of vendor risk management, or we'll call it now grantee risk management, it gives us the ability to say, you know what, out of a potential 200, you scored 30, and we would like to have you begin some remediation to boost up your scores through internal controls, compliance issues, and really get to the next level where we can say to the taxpayer of the state of Minnesota, to the administration, whomever that may be, that we have done our level best to make it so that we can confidently say we're doing our absolute best to ferret out any potential fraud in the future. It's a very simple concept, and I would stand for questions.
All right, two member questions. Chair Cleburne?
No, members, I would encourage the support. It's going to Ways and Means. I'm glad you pushed the implementation date so that administration has time to do the important work that they need to do. And so I would encourage a yes vote.
And Mr. Chair, Chair Cleburne, thank you for that. Just wanted to also mention that the Department of Administration is neutral on the bill, so they recognize that there's a place for this that can actually benefit the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion that 3682 as amended be referred to Ways and Means.
With that, Chair Nash renews his motion to re-refer House File 3682 to Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Aye.
Carried. Thank you, Chair Nash. Next bill up Is Representative Witte available? All right.
That was fast. That's good. Welcome, Representative Witte. And since you are not a member of the committee, I will move House File 3826 to come before the committee. Your bill is in front of us. Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, committee members. Thank you, Chair Nash and Chair Cleavorn. House File 3826 is a BCA policy bill related to the work of the BCA Financial Crimes and Fraud Section. The bill would provide additional tools to the BCA in its fight against all types of fraud in Minnesota. The bill expands identity theft to include AI or technology-based duplication of someone's likeness and extends the statute of limitations for some types of fraud-related crimes. This extension is important due to the complex nature of these crimes and helps ensure fraudsters are held accountable. I have Superintendent Drew Evans from the BCA with me to provide more information about the bill. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Evans, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nash and Chair Cleaver. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And as Representative Witte noted, we operate the Minnesota Financial Crimes and Fraud Section at the BCA. That section is responsible for investigating all types of financial crimes and fraud across Minnesota, including traditional financial crimes, wage theft, insurance fraud, and state program fraud. As we continue to do our work and refine and combat criminal fraud across the state of Minnesota, these were identified as gaps and areas that would help us with our work in doing that. In particular, we would expand the definition of identity theft to include AI-generated identities. In other words, using AI as we continue to see AI expanded for good uses in society. We're also seeing it utilized for negative and consequential uses. And so this would include that as a definition in our identity theft statute, which we have begun to start to see in this work. We would also extend the statute of limitations for a delineated set of financial crimes and theft statutes that are identified. And in particular, the reason for this is we want to hold fraudsters accountable. Oftentimes, these crimes are uncovered years after the fact. And so we can still hold people accountable by, doing these as what we call a paper crime. We really trace back the crime through the various records that are available to us, and we're able to hold them accountable. So it would expand those set of crimes to 7 years and clarify that the statute doesn't run until the actual fraud is discovered to ensure we have the appropriate time to be able to do that. And once in a while, we are running in with our work that we're not able to charge particular cases because in most instances, the statute of limitations is 3 years. So this would make sure we have plenty of time to do that. And then lastly, as we're doing our work in this, there's an area to expand subpoena authority. I think what's in front of you today would be able to expand the list of items that we're able to utilize a subpoena authority, both for the Attorney General and county attorneys that we work with each and every day. This is as amended in this, and it would make sure that we have the records that are necessary and available to move these cases forward to determine if there is a viable case. It's really for ease of efficiency in the process and to ensure that we have all the records available to ensure that we have that from there. And I might have, I see the look on the chair's face, this was amended in the other committee, so the engrossment that's in front of you, I apologize, I misspoke. So the language here is as it was amended in previous committee on this for that, giving that power and authority to both the Attorney General and the county attorney. And I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee chair.
Members, questions? Anyone? Chair Cleaver?
Thank you. And Representative Witte, I appreciate the work that you're doing here. I think it's really important. I think as we see the expansion of AI and the malicious side of it, right, this is really important work. It is my understanding that this is going to judiciary, but I also understand that it needs another trip to public safety. I just want to make sure that we're on the record that it will also return to public safety.
Representative Witte.
Yeah, that is correct, Chair Cleavorn. In public safety, Representative Pinto wants to work out one fine detail on it. So we have a meeting set up for this Friday, so we're just wanting to move the bill, and it would end up back at public safety.
Chair Cleavorn.
Thank you very much, Chair. And Representative Woody, I appreciate the way that you work, and I appreciate the fact that you're always open to work with me and our team to make sure that the bills are in good shape. So thank you. And with that, members, I would ask for a yes vote on this bill.
Representative Woody, I'll just say thank you for this. You know, anytime you have a tool that becomes as ubiquitous and intense as AI, you have to put up some guardrails around it. And it's important that we do that. It is literally the Wild West out there, and it can lead to crimes that most people never imagined. So I think that this is a bill that most Minnesotans would get behind, because you look at the profusion of AI and you realize sometimes you can't even tell that something that you're looking at is AI. And there are a good number of people who fall susceptible to crimes as a result of it. So thank you so much for this bill. Understand that it's going again to judiciary, and that's the referral for today. So any last questions? Once, twice, the chair then renews his motion that House File 3826 is referred to Judiciary. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? You're on your way.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay. Next we have, from Representative Novotny, we have House File 3990. And Chair Novotny, you are not a member of this committee, so I will move 3990 to come before the committee. There are no amendments, so please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nash. So Bill 3990 is a bill that was brought to us by MMB. It's a bill that I think is pretty specific, but once he explains the situation, will be very obvious why we need this bill. And I did most of the talking on the bill in public safety, so I'm going to turn the bill over so he can talk about it. And this is MMB Deputy Commissioner Blake Chafee.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah. Good morning, members, or Chair members. Blake Chafee, Deputy Commissioner from Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you, Chair Novotny, and appreciate your support in authoring the bill. Criminal Offender Rehabilitation Act was passed into law in 1974 to encourage and contribute to the rehabilitation of criminal offenders. The law establishes that public employers cannot disqualify an applicant solely based on a criminal conviction. As the law has been understood for a long time and up until very recently, there was some discretion allowed for public employers to disqualify an applicant if the conviction directly related to the employment sought, to the job sought, and there was not sufficient evidence of rehabilitation and present fitness for that position. However, a recent Court of Appeals decision, McNitt versus Minnesota, interpreted the law to mean that if an applicant can produce certain documents outlined in statute, that they are considered to be rehabilitated. In this case, an applicant was disqualified by Minnett for an IT position working for the Department of Education after a criminal background check showed a conviction for possession of child pornography. The Court of Appeals held that once the applicant provides that document listed in statute, so state or federal discharge order, that the applicant has satisfied the statutorily defined means of demonstrating rehabilitation. The decision by the appeals court fully removes the public employer's reasonable discretion to consider facts and seriousness of the crime and how those connect and relate specifically to employment sought. We feel it's reasonable that in this example, where someone that's been convicted of possession of child pornography and is seeking a job that has access to data systems containing information about children, that a more nuanced consideration of rehabilitation and present fitness should be allowed, and that it should be more than just sort of simply showing up with those discharge orders. Public employers are stewards of trust and welfare of Minnesotans. We do feel that restoring this reasonable discretion for public employers absolutely serves the public interest. This bill would clarify the law and restore the balance between providing second chances and allowing public employers appropriate discretion to make hiring decisions based on specific duties and access of the position. I'm happy to stop there and take any questions if the committee has them.
Members, questions? Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Chair Novotny and Mr. Chavey, I have a question about the deletion of language at lines 2.6 and 2.7. I'm guessing, based on Mr. Chavey's presentation, that might be at the very core of the changes that you want to make. But it is concerning to me that at 2.7, a shall consider is deleted and then is subbed in with the because of the renumbering with a may consider obligation. And the reason I think that this cuts both ways because of the language at lines 2.9 through 2.13 has, you know, two sets, or actually 2.16 has two sets of facts, some that are potentially exculpating and some that are sort of inculpating, which is the nature and seriousness of the crime and the circumstances of the crime, but and also the age of a person. In any event, things that might be mitigating. So based on this deletion, I understand that that public employers could choose not to consider any of this if they wanted to.
Mr. Chafee.
Go ahead,
sir. Or Chair Novotny.
Chair, Representative, I would point to line, that's not our interpretation, and I would point to line 110 with the addition of both. And so what we see that addition of both, uh-huh, and then sort of separating into these two pieces is that the public employer, and this is to us is a very narrow lane when the employment sought relates directly to the crime that was committed, that both of those things should apply. So first, right, that evidence of rehabilitation, the potential discharge records, the pieces at the top of the bill, and then also sort of, again, in an instance where it's where the crime is directly connected to employment sought, that reasonable discretion for the employer to consider that crime. And so we see the amendment, or not the amendment, but the language here, pointing very directly to that both, right? The sort of paperwork part, and then when the crime is related to employment sought, being able to make that consideration for the public employer.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the issue that I have is that the individual may be able to show both those things, and that's they have that opportunity in subdivision 3, paragraph A. But in subparagraph B, you can choose the aperture through which you look at those factors. You may consider the things that they offer to you, but you may not if you choose not to because of the mandated language being stricken.
Chair Novotny or Mr. Chafee?
Thank you, Chair Nash. To me, this is language that we did work for and work out for quite a while in the off session to make a specific and very closely allotted so that it takes into consideration the specifics of the conviction and the access that this employee would have to specific data, and I believe the language in the bill does do that. And you know, there's always a weighing. We know that people will need to be rehabilitated, but weighing that against what the access that they have, especially in a situation like access to all this data from the Department of Education, we feel that the access of that position is just too important not to have this language in, so there is some reasonable discretion from an employer.
Representative Luger-Nicolai, any follow-up?
Just to wrap, I think I understand the importance of discretion, and I actually think that if you don't strike the mandatory language that requires at least a consideration of the factors, it is still discretionary as to how they get weighed, but at least they're all on the table when the public agency is assessing rehabilitation. So that's the concern I have.
Very good. Chair Cleburne, you wanted to?
I just want a clarification because we have another bill later today, and I want to make sure that I'm like rowing all of the bills in the same direction. So are you saying, Mr. Chafee, that if an individual is working in the state of Minnesota and they, let's say, commit a financial crime, but they are capable of doing a different position within public employment in their field that has nothing to do with money, then they should be given a second chance.
Mr. Chafee.
Potentially given a second chance.
Chair Cleavorn, yes, that's correct. If someone were convicted of financial crime, applied for a job, hypothetically, applied for a job with the state, you know, if that was an agency CFO position, I think we would exercise, take a harder look at the specific criminal conviction, how that would relate to the position, but it would not prevent them from holding, to your point, Chair, a different job at the state that was not directly related to that conviction and that sort of thing.
Chair Cleavorn.
No, thank you. I just wanted that clarification on the record because I do think second chances are important for people. I mean, different times, different places, people can make mistakes for different reasons. So I do think second chances are important. Thank you.
Very good. Any other member questions? And I forgot to ask if there were members of the public that would like to test. Oh, okay. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on what Representative Luger-Nicolai said. Look, I'm not a lawyer on this stuff, but I do think the point she raises, and it's the May, now with the May you have in 1.9, the May in 1.14, I think she raises a good point, that it's become that, like, none of this stuff needs to be considered.
Representative Novotny or Mr. Chafee?
Go ahead. Chair, Representative, understand where you're coming from. I think that, you know, the language that is in front of you is language that we've worked on with the chair, to his earlier point, to craft what we see is a really narrow lane for that employer discretion. Since CORA was passed, there was, employer discretion existed for a long time, up until, as I said in testimony a little bit ago, until this McNitt decision sort of placed all of the weight on one side of the equation, right? There is sort of crime sought, how that relates to public employment, and then paperwork, records of discharge, things that would point to rehabilitation. The proposed language here is we see as narrowly tailored and about restoring that really narrow lane of public employer discretion, because we would agree rehabilitation is possible. Giving folks a second chance is really important. We just feel that giving public employers that really, I think, limited narrow lane of discretion when that conviction speaks directly to and relates directly to is important.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. I'm not arguing what you're trying to do at all, but I'm just saying the way the two Mays work seems like it may be causing could cause unintended consequences, and I just asked you to look at that really carefully.
Okay. Chair Novotny, any follow-up?
It is carefully crafted, I believe it is, and I look at other jobs where we consider the specific duties and the access to their positions. I'll fall back, as normally what I do, to my experience in law enforcement, and there are disqualifying convictions for law enforcement officers, and the biggest one being theft, because you have such exposure and you have such access to things. A single theft conviction, rightly, I feel, should block you from ever being a law enforcement officer again, forever, no matter how qualified you are, because if you get back into that position, you would still have that same exposure, and that's just not the risk to me. When we look at a specific case like this, knowing from investigations that I did do into individuals that were involved in CSAM or child pornography, it is something that is specific to this individual's conviction, and I think that the conviction with the access and their exposure and the responsibility is just too much, and I would put the the trust in the state to make sure that, you know, someone with this specific conviction and background with the access that they would have as that employee, I would trust the state to make that specific decision.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. You know, I think this is an interesting bill in that I think we all appreciate the concept of making sure that we are demonstrating that someone has the ability to rehabilitate. I also really appreciate the idea of being able to weigh additional factors here, like the nature and seriousness of the crime, and to put in perspective the nature of the crime with the actual position. So, for example, if a nurse gets convicted of check fraud, for example, if she is going to be working in Greater Minnesota in a place where there's a high demand for nurses and she will have no access to financial records, but she is very qualified as a nurse and could be an excellent nurse, she has the ability to do that. And that could be considered because on her employment application, she will no doubt need to disclose that she would have a felony conviction. And so I appreciate all of that. I do share some of the concerns around some of the maze. I certainly appreciate that we do that, but I just want to say that I think we might want to make sure that the intent will be there as intended, or the intent should be followed. That would be my one concern on this particular bill as it moves forward. And, Mr. Chair, where is this bill going?
This is going to the General Register.
Okay. That makes me a little bit anxious because we seem a little bit like we have not quite determined yet where this should go, but or whether or not this is entirely accurate. I guess it gives me a little trepidation, but I do appreciate the intent of what you're trying to do here.
Okay, I didn't hear a question in there. Just want to make sure. Very good. Okay, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I look at, this is individuals are individuals, and you've got to have the flexibility to do the right thing. It's hard to write in something that says do not put them in a position of being tempted again to do a crime or tempted to do some wrongdoing. We cannot write a 5 million page law to have everything set down there. This bill is trying to set some guidelines and allow the flexibility to take into account the exact details of a situation. Perfection, I don't know if I've seen that in the House since I've been here, but I think this is a good approach to, again, allow for reentry to work. But I agree there's a lot of fuzzy stuff around, but I believe this is a true and honest approach to succeed in this effort. Thank you.
Members, anything further? And then again, I will mention that I'll get to you, Chair Cleveland. Are there members of the public that would like to testify once, twice? Seeing none, Chair Cleveland.
Thank you. And I just want to say thank you for bringing the bill. Thank you for your diligence. I would ask you to continue working with our members that have questions on our side of the aisle. If we need a floor amendment, I would ask that you please consider that as well. I will be voting yes. I'm going to say to the members on our side, exercise your election certificate, do what you think best, but I will be voting in favor of the bill moving, and I appreciate the need for second chances. Thank you.
Chair Novotny, closing remarks.
I absolutely will work to get this in the shape that you need to get this through because I feel it is important. And I'd also like to point out that, you know, should there be someone that is refused employment because of this language, they still have a court remedy. This bill just gives the option for the courts to make a decision in reasonableness. And with that, I ask for your vote.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. I think it's a very good bill. I think it's well-crafted, well thought out, and that it provides a lot of flexibility as needed to deal with it on a case-by-case basis. And with that, the chair renews his motion that House File 3990 be referred to the General Register. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? The motion carries, and it is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Chair Novotny. Yep. Next, we have Representative Anderson's bill, House File 3563. As Representative Anderson makes her way to the testifiers table, the chair will move 3563 to come before the committee and to be referred to the General Register. Representative Anderson, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nash and members. This is a very simple bill. It's been going through committees. I do not have any testifiers in to save time, but we had some at the last in the Health Committee. But the bill essentially just says that it's for fraud, and it says that the board shall revoke licenses of people that are convicted of generally fraud crimes. So it's very simple. One question I got the last committee is, isn't this already done? And in some cases, it is, and in many other cases, it's not. So this is a just a blanket bill that says that it needs to get done. So thank you. That's it.
Okay. There is a fiscal note in your packet, members, and it shows zero cost. We'd like to refer to that. Are there any members of – we'll get to you guys. I'm going to open it up to the public for testimony first. Are there any members of the public that would like to testify? That many. Okay, member questions. I saw Representative Kraft poke his hand up first. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. Yes, simple bill in terms of numbers of lines and everything. But can you take me through what problem you're trying to solve for that isn't already solved? You know, because it is does create a need that creates the need for a lifetime ban, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. and as you said, I think in your opening remarks that in many cases this is already done. Mm-hmm. So what are the situations that you're adding to this and why?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. For example, in the peace officers, you know, if you have a peace officer's license and you're convicted of one of these crimes, they are going to pull your license, peace officer. But there are also licenses for various things, mostly in the health area, where if you're convicted, let's say you're a pharmacist and you're convicted of being involved in fraud scams through you know, you're signing documents for, or doctors signing documents for the paid family leave, and that's fraudulently done. So that's a case where this would get kicked in.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are there, has that happened? Do you have examples of that happening that you're trying to address with this? Because I think in some of those instances, if someone commits a crime or a felony, they're going to be booted, right? So mm-hmm. what are these edge cases that we're adding?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. I don't have an example because we don't know what's been happening out there, what's been happening with licenses. We had a testifier at the last hearing who was involved in the RIDE program, which we know there's a lot of fraud, and we know that the numbers since we've had the non-emergency medical licensing, you know, and the fraud coming in, that those rides are down like 65%. It's significant, and some of those folks are licensed, and all of a sudden, you know, they're not, you know, so they were talking. That testifier in particular was talking about the fact that companies that are involved in fraudulent activity like that should not be licensed anymore as a non-emergency medical license provider. In that case, there is no legislation that says that their license should be pulled automatically. Their licensing for that company. So that was
Kraft.
A very good example. So.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in this what you're proposing, how would the process change? Like, how would this work in these cases? Like, what's happening today, and how would it change?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. The boards would need to, essentially, you would be notified if somebody is convicted, and it would be an automatic pulling of their other licenses. So licenses that they use to do business with the state fraudulently in some cases, but it would be automatically pulled.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess today those boards would examine the situation and make a decision whether the license needs to be pulled. And what you're saying is you would be saying, look, you don't get to review that, and now it's just automatic. In these cases that we're not quite sure what they are, but if they come up, we pull the authority away from those boards.
Yeah.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. And it's correct. And it is it's very clear in this case that it would be pulled. And these are for convictions, not just for allegations, not just for potential charges. These are for actual convictions.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm good.
Representative Luger-Nicolai, I believe you're next.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I just want to drill down, because at the beginning you said this is happening in many cases. These things aren't initiated, but you don't actually know how many times they are initiated. Is that correct?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I think what I said is that in many cases it's already done. So it's the app kind of a little different.
And then you said, but in some cases.
Speak to the chair.
Yep, Mr. Chair, sorry. But then additionally, you said in other cases they are not, that it doesn't happen. Is that, do you know?
Representative Anderson?
We've been told that that's the case by the agencies. So, but in cases of peace officers, those sort of things, it is done automatically.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Okay, and then in health occupational licensing, several of the boards have diversionary programs through which they may work to rehabilitate a licensee rather than issue discipline. So this would prevent them from using that type of program in instances like this, correct?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Representative Luger-Nicolai, if they are convicted of one of these, then they would have to take action. They would have to pull a license.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Okay, I am concerned about that, because those programs actually have been very successful, especially with respect to the nursing board, in terms of returning someone to work. It's absolutely stipulated that the crimes that are listed in this bill are obviously of a deep concern to everybody and are not good. But if this creates an auto revocation situation when, in fact, the board would ordinarily have the ability to determine somebody may require revocation, or they may be redeemable, they may be rehabable. They may be susceptible of rehabilitation, that this takes away an option that the board has. So I think, is not a development that I would support.
Representative Anderson, follow up to that?
Yep. The other thought, if we are going to deal with fraud in this state, which we know is extensive, we have to have serious consequences for fraud. And if people are defrauding our public programs, if they are defrauding our citizens, if they're defrauding our state government, they need to know that there's serious consequences. And I think that's been part of the problem, is that those consequences haven't been serious. So this is a serious consequence, that if you defraud people that need services, and if you defraud state programs and state government, there is a very serious consequence. So that's what this does.
Okay, members, any other questions? Representative Bonner.
So thank you for that. I've been doing a lot of thinking on this bill since its last stop. And I have to be honest, I'm concerned. And I think my concern is, in the last bill, we had a conversation about rehabilitation, and we had a conversation about the ability to have options to consider all the factors in a case and how those play out, right? The seriousness of the offense, whether it has to it pertains to the actual job at hand, things like that. In this bill, we're doing exactly the opposite of that, right? We are taking away that, and I'm going to go back to that example of a nurse, right? So let's say a nurse is convicted of a felony because, let's say, they tried to obtain nutrition assistance to put food on their table. Mm-hmm. or they got convicted of trying to put a roof over their head by seeking some sort of housing or medical assistance. But then they turn around and they go to apply for a job as a nurse in Greater Minnesota, where we have desperate shortages. And they are now going to be disqualified from being able to apply their trade and put food on their table and put a roof over their head, because they've been automatically disqualified with no potential for redemption whatsoever. And we are not able to consider the circumstances under which that happened. And I find that deeply troubling, to be honest, because it seems to smack of not giving anyone sort of this idea of the ability or a remedy to seek if in fact they've been wronged or something has not gone as planned. And I know that, first of all, we're having a moment when we talk about fraud. And there is no one in this room who thinks fraud is okay. Everybody here universally agrees fraud is bad. We all universally agree that folks who commit fraud should be held fully accountable and serve time if that is in fact determined to be the case. Nobody disputes that. But what we're talking about here is potentially taking away someone's livelihood forever without being able to consider any of the other factors. And can I just ask, is it not the ability of licensing boards today to be able to consider discretionary factors and in their decisions on whether or not to pull a license or not pull a license?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. If an attorney does something wrong and commits fraud, they're debarred. If a doctor does something wrong, their medical licenses are pulled. So this is how what we do. And if, again, if we are going to be serious about fraud, there has to be consequences to fraud. There has to be consequences to committing fraud in the state.
Representative Bonner.
Well, to your point that you just gave, the punishment should fit the crime to some extent, right? But you gave examples of crimes that were committed that related directly to the person's profession. If you have a situation in which someone is convicted of a crime that has nothing to do with their profession, then why should they be disbarred or removed from their ability to put a food on their table and a roof over their head in the skill in which they're trained for?
Representative Anderson.
I think, and maybe that wasn't the best example, but I think that, again, there has to be consequences to fraud. We have to be serious about it. And we license people in various occupations as a state. And as part of that license, that's upholding the public trust. That's saying that you are someone who we think, you know, that you should be a nurse, that you know, we trust you with that. And if people are committing fraud against state programs, serious crimes and convicted of crimes, they should be held accountable. And they should know on the front end, I could lose my occupational licensing if I do something like this.
Representative Bonner, last question.
Thank you. I will just say we literally just said yes to a bill that provided the flexibility for individuals to have discretion. We literally just passed it. Like, we all said yes around this table. And now we are taking away that discretion. We're taking away the ability to set guidelines and have flexibility in those decisions. And I find that, you know, again, fraud is bad. We all agree. Nobody disputes it. But it feels like in this case, we are going a step too far, and we are not considering the ability of an employer to decide whether a nurse convicted of some other crime could still be a good nurse. I find that troubling, and I find that what this bill is essentially doing is completely taking away a remedy from an individual to have any say if they've been wronged. or if there's some path forward. And I think we would assume that an individual who has gone to school, who has the training, who has gone through all the rigors of that work, who can be a competent professional in their chosen field, should not have their trade taken away and not be able to no longer be a productive member of society because we've automatically taken their license away and taken away any flexibility or any ability to actually have license boards have a say in whether or not the offense actually fits within the profession that they're chosen. And I find that very, very troubling. I'm going to be a no on this vote, or on this vote today.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward. We all know and we hear about the magnitude and the widespread and the horrific abuses of fraud in our programs. This bill, contrary to what was heard on the other side, is for a person who is convicted of a court of a competent jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. They've already had their say, their ability to defend themselves and prove themselves innocent. Here we have the Democrats, again, standing up for fraudsters. Last week or so, they had the audacity to suggest that maybe we should study the benefits of retail theft. And we have them going off today, and I'm getting a little frustrated. We're going off defending people who have been convicted in a court of competent jurisdiction. And we're adding a few extra statutes. I appreciate that you're bringing this bill forward because Republicans are serious about fighting crime. If you look at the statutes that are added into this bill, it's for people that are wrongfully obtaining assistance. And also the 609 chapter, concealing criminal proceeds. I'm sorry, but it's absolutely right that they should not have their license renewed. Thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Representative Bonner, did you wish to be recognized again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask that members not put words in my mouth and not impugn motives. Thank you.
Representative Kosnick.
Mr. Chair, previously we had the representative that just spoke speak for all of us around the table. Maybe I agreed, but I certainly don't see other representatives being serious about fighting fraud. They talk about it all the time, and I'm getting tired of it, because when they oppose a bill like this that's common sense, it shouldn't be that difficult, and don't impugn our motives because you're talking out of both sides of your mouth.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. Let's just take a pause. Let's slow down. We don't need to do any name calling in our committee, and I'm sure Chair Nash agrees with that.
I was getting there.
Thank you. So I just want to kind of level set, just a moment. One, Representative Anderson, I would like to thank you for your commitment to working against fraud. Mm-hmm. I will speak for the members of the committee because I think I've heard every one of us say this, and Representative Kosnick, you can attack me if you wish, but I believe that every member of this committee understands and believes that zero fraud is permissible. We all agree that fraud harms the public, and we all agree that fraud harms our programs. Every one of us agrees on that. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we all agree on that. To your example earlier, that when a lawyer is convicted of fraud, mm-hmm. that it's an automatic disbarment. It is not an automatic disbarment. I just want to level set. I've served on the Lawyers Board of Professional Responsibility for 6 years. They are potentially disbarred for a period of time. They are potentially allowed to come back to work. If it's a financial crime, there will be supervision, there will be audits, there will be remedies. but they are not necessarily, for sure, permanently barred for life from serving in their profession. So I just want to say there are examples that I think if we wanted to do that on a broad scale, then we would want to include people like CPAs. But that's not what this bill does. And actually, I'm not 100% sure why this bill is in our committee. The statute that you're looking at has a lot to do with physical harm to individuals. And if you are physically harming people, then maybe that's not the best profession, and you should have that permanent bar. But for financial crimes, I do believe that the situation is very important. And so I do agree with Vice Chair Bonner that boards should have the ability to review the situation. So I'm going to be a no vote on this bill today. And my side can vote however they want, but I will be a no vote on the bill. And I do think that in light of the previous bill, these are in contradiction of one another. Mm-hmm. People deserve second chances. So agree with you 100%. Fraud is bad. No fraud is acceptable. Agree with that. But when it comes to the licensing board, I say let them do their jobs. And that's what they're here for.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I ask for a roll call on this.
Roll call will be granted.
And to all members, you know, I'm new on this committee, but I'm struck by the fact that we can't seem to agree on a lot of things that pertain to fraud. We can't pass an OIG bill out of this committee for reasons we all have. And here's a bill that I think would send a message that in Minnesota we will not tolerate fraud anymore. And I think we all kind of agree to that. And yet we can't agree to do that because some are saying there needs to be more flexibility. Well, maybe if there weren't flexibility and somebody would lose their license, as this bill pertains to, it would send a message. Mm-hmm. And it was mentioned about a nurse. Well, if a nurse is guilty of theft or fraud, should they be handling medications and things like that? I would have some issues with that. But again, I'm struck by the fact that we all say the same things, but we can't agree on anything. And it's frustrating, but I think this bill does send a message that we will not tolerate fraud in this state. And I'm frustrated that we can't agree to that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And I would note, Representative Anderson, you've been on the committee now for 2 whole years, so you're not that new anymore. You're a veteran of the state of FI. Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. I am a freshman, so I'm trying to understand. I see the word suspend, and I interpret suspend as a temporary revocation as opposed to a complete revocation. So there is opportunity in this bill for someone to regain their license the way I read it, but I could be corrected, and I'm willing to take that. But I also see this bill as being a very strong deterrent. I have a commercial pilot's license. If I were to get a DUI, potentially the FAA could revoke my commercial pilot's license. Well, that's a deterrent for me to get that. That has nothing to do with how I fly the aircraft, but it represents something that would endanger the lives of the people who might be flying on the aircraft right behind me. So I strongly support this bill. I think it's a huge deterrent to fraud, and we need to be looking at the deterrence to fraud, not just what are we going to do after somebody commits fraud. Thank you.
Okay, we, members, Representative Joy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for this bill. You know, I'm trying to sit here and think it's now March 17th. We've been in session for a while. I'm trying to think what fraud we've tackled, the things we've came forward with, and what we've went after. And I'm really curious. I wish we had a spreadsheet going right now to show Minnesotans that we're attacking fraud, and we're making sure it's not going to happen when we leave this session in May. But everything's been voted down side by side. They can, you know, we talk about we want to be good stewards of taxpayers' money. We want to prevent fraud from happening. And then we bring bills up, and they're voted down. They die in committee, and they just lay in committee. We bring them up again, they die in committee. So are we serious about taking care of fraud, or are we just serious about having hearings, moving bills through? Because our priority this session should be dealing with fraud, tackling fraud. This has happened. This is what's happened because we haven't checks and balances. This thing we're running down here is a P&L. This is checks and balances in the checkbook. When we see fraud happening, when you have a bank card and you see fraud on it, they cancel your bank card regularly. We have not addressed this yet in Minnesota. We can say we all want to see fraud quit, but what are we really doing? What are we going to go back and tell our taxpayers that we did stop? These are the bills that put the checks and balances in to be good stewards of your taxpayers' money. I have not seen it yet. We continually go back and forth talking about, oh, we want to stop fraud. We hope to get this done. The OIG bill, the Senate, great job, guys. 60-7 passed that bill. We bring it over here, completely dismantle it. We cannot even move it forward. You know, it's still sitting in committee. Here we are, March 17th, trying to be good stewards of taxpayers' money. Does not work. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for this bill.
Okay, Representative Anderson, concluding words before we go to a vote.
Thank you. Well, I again ask it that, as you see, it is initiate proceedings to suspend or revoke the license or not renew. So it isn't, this initiates the proceedings essentially. But this is a basic thing to help make it tougher, make people rethink when they're going to, if they're thinking about committing fraud. It puts a consequence on the action. And if we don't start creating consequences for committing fraud, we're never going to get rid of fraud. So I ask that you consider supporting this, send it to the general register, and we'll give it a vote.
And so, members, I didn't see Representative Kraft sought to get recognized before we gave Representative Anderson. So very briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two comments. One is, look, it cuts both ways. We had a OIG bill here. Hard work done by Representative Norris with things that improved on the Senate's bill, and you refused to entertain those and accept anything other than superficial amendments. So, look, we are serious about it. There should be no fraud, and I'm, you know, and just want to level set there. And secondly, this bill, look, there should be no fraud, but what I heard is going after a narrow process that already seems to be working with no examples that this is going to do anything. And maybe it makes us feel good about saying, hey, we've done something that is going to have virtually no impact. So I'm a no.
Clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Chair Nash, aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, no.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, aye.
Representative Clardy.
Clardy, no.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Jones.
Jones, no.
Representative Joy.
Joy wants to stop fraud, yes.
Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, yes.
Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
No.
Representative Quam. Yes. Representative Sexton.
Absolutely, yes.
There being 7 ayes and 7 nays, the bill does not progress to the general register. I will now turn the gavel over to Representative Davis, and I have a bill up in another committee.
All right, is Representative Kreshaw available? I'm going to move. Representative Kreshaw can make his way to the table. I will move your bill, House File 3674, before the committee. And we'll make a motion to refer to the Energy Committee.
Chair Davis.
Yes.
While he's getting ready, we'll ask for a roll call.
Very good. Roll call has been requested. Representative Kreshaw, your bill's before the committee.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. So what you have in front of you, I hope, I have an expert testifier who understands this way more than I, but when the first time I heard this, I just raised an eyebrow and went, really? We're duplicating these efforts and we're creating this type of uncertainty out in the regulatory market. So as I heard this and took the bill up, and thank you for that opportunity, what I realized is this is really an in-the-weeds bill. This is about cleaning up some duplicity out there, and actually freeing up some time for the AG's office to work on other things. So I'm actually trying to take things off of the AG's office plate. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Chairman, if that's agreeable.
Please state your name and who you're with and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Eric Lipman of Utility Reform Now, and grateful for the members' time. With respect to House File 3674, and it's being re-referred to Energy, is that the motion?
Yes, sir.
That is correct, Mr. Lipman.
Okay. It relates, while it is relating to the utility market, certainly, it's in this bill because House File 3674 would redeploy, remove the mandate for, and allow for the immediate redeployment of the state's very best forensic audit team and make them available to go after $9 billion worth of Medicaid fraud. $9 billion worth of Medicaid fraud. As the handout suggests, the government's own documents show four things about utility regulation. There are a lot of resources spent by four different state agencies to supervise, in this particular case, this is Xcel Energy, a single company. Many of the members here represent areas in the metro area that are served by natural gas service, by Xcel Energy. And so let's look at the regulatory fees that we're paying for those proceedings. The department, the commission, the Office of the Attorney General, the Court of Administrative Hearings, all of whom, all four agencies, are served either by assistant attorney generals or receive a delegation of authority for their lawyers. In the case of the Court of Administrative Hearings, where I worked for 19 years, they serve under a delegation from the Attorney General. So there's lots of roles for the Attorney General. But those processes and the doubling up that we're doing, tripling up, quadrupling up, is very expensive to your constituents. If they're Xcel Energy customers, by way of examples, but it happens with all nine rate-regulated utilities, the current charges that Xcel is setting aside in this current rate case now pending is $3.5 million, a procedure that the Public Utilities Commission voted for when they sent for this for a notice and order for hearing. They're guaranteeing $1 million in government official expenses, that's in the regulatory fees, and another $2.5 million that Xcel and their lawyers in the hearing process is going to add on to their bill, onto the bills of your constituents, really for something that is pretty simple. The question in that case is whether this table of 48 numbers is reasonable, and they're going to charge the poorest people in your district on a per-therm basis $3.5 million to tell us whether this table of 48 numbers is reasonable or not. I think it's a scandal. I think it's a scandal. It's not a very complicated question. Moreover, I guess I would invite members, to the extent that you have a pencil or a pen handy, maybe you can guess, and I'll give you a hint, it's a number between 1 and 50, how many attorneys and analysts that are not associated with Xcel Energy are combing through Xcel Energy's financial information, all of which is posted on the internet for everyone all across the globe to be able to access. I got these documents from the internet. I'm not a government official. I'm not an insider at Xcel, but I get these documents just like anybody could get them. So I would ask members to maybe just play a little game with me. Guess how many government attorneys and NGO attorneys and analysts are looking over the financial information. If you guessed 49, you're correct, 49. And the radical, I don't think so radical, proposition of 3674 is, can we take seven of those folks and put them on to trying to claw back the $9 billion in Medicaid fraud that's gone out the door? This committee has a zero target. I think you might have a larger than a zero target if we didn't lose $9 billion. I think your constituents want to get the $9 billion back. That's really super important. And how do I know that? Well, Governor Walz, in Executive Order 2510, says this. We must ensure that agencies and last I checked, the Attorney General's office was an agency, must have the ability to make necessary changes to stop fraud and to organize across the enterprise effectively to root out fraud and to have all possible tools to refer criminal behavior for future prosecution. And in fact, I'm delighted that Ms. Hinderly of the RUD is here. She leads the best forensic team in state government. She's not needed to be a fourth chair, and that's what she is, a fourth chair, on looking over Xcel's financials. In the Xcel energy rate case, there are, of the 49, there are 16 officials from the Department of Commerce, 7 from the Attorney General's Office, RUD, 5 from the Citizens Utility Board, 5 from the Suburban Rate Authority, 15 from the Public Utilities Commission.
Mr. Lippman, about 30 seconds.
And 1. And so I think we should make the best fraud team in the state. And folks are going to ask you at the door, hey, can we get any of the $9 billion back? I don't want you to have to answer, no, I'm sorry. They're busy being the fourth chair in a team of 49 doing something else. This is our state's most important priority. The governor says so. Judge O'Malley and our fraud czar said so. It's time in this committee for you folks to say we're going to send the Green Berets to get the money back. That's what we need to do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Representative Kreshaw, anything else?
No.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Lippman. I believe is there a Mr. Shardlow, if he could make his way to the testifiers table, and the Attorney General is here as well, I believe. Please do. Please state your name for the record, tell us who you're with, and proceed with your testimony, Mr. Shardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Cleburne. My name is George Shardlow, and I'm with the Energy Sense Coalition. We're a 501c3 organization that advocates for low-income utility customers, and I'm here today to attest to the incredible value that the Office of Attorney General does in the capacity of advocating for small commercial and residential customers in particular. I think it matters in advocacy and policy analysis where we direct our focus. I'm deeply grateful for the work of all of the vestiges of the state that have been referenced, but I think that I say focus matters because the fact that one of those vestiges focuses on the interests of the senior on a fixed income who got scammed through a third-party dealer and had a billing error, and many of these micro-level issues that could easily get lost in proceedings that by necessity take a global view of this incredibly large and complex system. I think the fact that this infrastructure exists deeply impacts which issues get elevated and analyzed and advocated on. And so we as low-income advocates, we as consumer advocates are grateful for the work that's done and would strongly encourage this committee to protect that work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shardlow. Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ranking Member, and thank you to the author and all members.
Please state your name for the record. Yeah. My apologies.
Right. My name is Keith Ellison. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota.
You're that guy.
That'd be me. That'd be me, sir, Representative. And quite frankly, this bill would drive up energy bills by eliminating the Attorney General's office role as an advocate for residential ratepayers and small businesses. The fact is that imagine you're a senior or disabled person living on a fixed income. You already got hit by over 20% hike in gas prices. So you're staring that right in the eye right now. and you hear that your utility company is about to try to raise your power bill. Maybe they want a new power plant. Maybe they are claiming they're going to do something good with the money, like, I don't know, do more green infrastructure or something. Could be meritorious. I'm not saying that they're not doing good things or plan to do good things with the money. Or maybe they just think the CEO needs a higher salary. Who knows? But they want you, the ratepayer, to pay for it. What do you do? Well, the people who can approve or reject that rate increase are going to hear from the utility company. You better believe that that company will hire some of the finest lawyers, economists, and experts that money can buy. They're going to put together an incredibly detailed argument of exactly why you, the ratepayer, should foot the bill for whatever it is that they want to do. So how do you fight that? What do you do about that, up against all that? Well, now, today, you can count on the AGO's Residential Utilities Division, or RUD, and I hope that you'll hear from the leader of that division in a moment. But not if this bill passes. RUD is a small but mighty team. Eight staffers, four lawyers, three analysts, and a support staff. It's a team that advocates on behalf of everyday Minnesotans, also known as residential ratepayers or small businesses. Their work is absolutely essential because utilities are by design a monopoly. Earlier testifier said, just one company that happens to be a monopoly. Very important fact, that is. Utility companies can propose rate increases, and if the Public Utilities Commission approves them, they go into effect. When that happens, you can't just shop around for a better plan because the company is a monopoly. So when regulators are deciding how much these companies can charge, it is essential that they hear from everyone their decision is going to impact. Like I said earlier, utility companies will hire experts to make the most compelling case possible. It's going to sound good because the best people have worked to make sure it sounds good. But the fact is that big businesses will hire these experts to try to keep their own rates as low as possible. But Ms. McGillicuddy, all of our neighbor, right? She's the one who's worried about her own power bill. She doesn't have an economist on retainer. The five people at RUD are those experts who advocate on behalf of her, everyday Minnesotans, and small businesses. And my office's RUD work does outstanding work, and I want to thank Mr. Lipman for pointing that out. They do a great job. Time and time again, they have prevented many millions of dollars in utility bill increases for everyday Minnesotans. In 2024 alone, RUD managed to reduce rate increases for ratepayers by over $11 million. That's not even counting the work they did alongside any other agency. That's just RUD. And RUD's budget is a small fraction of the $11 million that they save for Minnesotans in 2024. I promise you that whatever Minnesotans pay in taxes to support the work of these eight people, they get back in savings many, many, many times over. Here are just a few examples, if I may. Xcel was trying to bill Minnesota ratepayers for their CEO's very, very generous salary. This is not theoretical. This is factual. RUD has argued that ratepayers should only pay for the CEO's salary where Xcel has shown he's actually working on behalf of ratepayers rather than shareholders. Regulations permitting utility companies to pass along reasonable expenses for employee travel and entertainment go along to ratepayers. RUD works to ensure that those expenses are actually reasonable, that their work has stopped Minnesota ratepayers from picking up some of these very expensive tabs that you see passed along. And here's one of the something that may surprise us here. RUD has often argued that ratepayers should not unreasonably subsidize investments in electric vehicle infrastructure. Now, anybody who knows me knows that I'm for that kind of stuff. But the question is, who pays? Does Ms. McGillicuddy pay? Or does the big company pay that's going to benefit the most? Or people who can afford an expensive EV? Because RUD represents all residential ratepayers, many of whom do not own and cannot afford an EV. They advocate that customers making that transportation choice should pay more of any necessary costs to add or upgrade infrastructure to serve EVs. Not anti-EV, just who pays for it. RUD is the only group, contrary to what you may have heard, whose exclusive focus is residential ratepayers and small businesses. And so there is more to be said here, but Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, I will wrap up. But I do hope, Mr. Chair, you can hear just a little bit from the person who does hands-on every day, and that is Catherine Henderly, who's right, sitting right behind me.
Thank you, Attorney General Ellison. Catherine Henderly, and then also if Sydney Lieb could make her way to the table as well if she's here to testify. Please state who you are and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Davis and members. My name is Catherine Henderly. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I manage RUD. I'm testifying today to talk about the work of my team. I'm here to answer any questions you might have about what that work is, and I'm hopefully here to dispel some misconceptions. And so I'd like to start with that last part for a moment first from some of the items you heard from Mr. Lipman today. I thank Mr. Lipman for the confidence and vote of confidence in RUD's ability to be forensic accountants, but I need to correct the record that no one in RUD has any experience with forensic accounting. No one has any experience with criminal investigations or criminal law enforcement, and no one has any experience as a former prosecutor. We do have 40 years of experience combined, over 40 years of doing work at the PUC for Minnesota's residential and small business ratepayers. Regarding, I think you heard a lot about extensive regulatory expenses in this space. And so looking at Mr. Lipman's Utility Reform Now's handout, I do want to just correct a couple items on there because I believe they were inaccurately represented to the committee. So in the on the first page, there's a box that kind of lists out various regulatory fees or what we call rate case expenses. And those include outside legal fees, that's $1.6 million on here, consulting fees, that's about half a million, regulatory fees, and even $1 million, and then administrative costs, $500,000. So first off, I want to point out these are all estimates. The utilities submit these as an estimate of what it will cost them to litigate the costs of their requested rate increase. The second thing I want to point out is that these do not include all the costs that the utilities incur in litigating their rate cases. Nowhere on here is there included the cost of internal utility employee time that is spent on these. They are reimbursed from that for ratepayers, but that's through a different accounting mechanism. It does include the cost of hiring three of the very largest and very best law firms in Minneapolis in that $1.6 million figure. It also includes $500,000 for ROE support, which is the utility hiring an outside consultant to argue for a higher profit margin. So those are costs that we're up against. The regulatory fees do include work of our AAGs who represent the Department of Commerce and the PUC. They don't include RUD, and that's because RUD does not actually have the ability to pass its costs on to the customers of the utility, to your constituents. We're funded by the general appropriation of the Attorney General's office. And so for that, I would thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have about the work we do.
Thank you, Catherine Henderly. Ms. Lieb, are you here? Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Good morning, Chair, Committee. Sydney Lieb with the Minnesota Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce, Office of Regulatory Affairs, and the Residential Utility Division in the Office of the Attorney General are distinct entities with separate goals, objectives, and priorities, which are set by their distinct and separate leadership, the governor and the attorney general, respectively. Both entities intervene in dockets before the Public Utilities Commission and contested case proceedings, which are often rate cases or other complicated dockets. The statement that all utility financial information necessary to convene a utility rate case is publicly available online is just not true. Utility investment decisions are complicated and based on detailed risk analysis that balances reliability, affordability, and compliance with a wide range of state and federal goals and laws. Determining the correct level of utility investment across a wide range of spending categories is a complicated process that requires several analysts with deep technical expertise. While we're in the midst of the energy transition, there's often a tension between ratepayer short-term financial interests and state environmental policies and goals. The Department of Commerce and RUD embody this tension, and the dialogue and analysis of the two agencies provides an important juxtaposition of these priorities as regulators work to find the correct balance of affordability, reliability, and compliance with state laws. The tension is intentional and stems directly from the statutory distinction between the two agencies. Under Minnesota Statute 8.33, RUD is responsible for representing and furthering the interests of residential and small business utility consumers through participation in matters between the Public Utilities Commission. That is their single and only goal. In contrast, the department is under Statute 216A07 subdivision 3A, and that statute provides the following guidance on how the Department of Commerce behaves in rate cases. When intervening in a gas or electric hearing, the Commissioner of Commerce shall prepare and defend testimony designed to encourage energy conservation improvements, ensure that greenhouse gas reduction goals are attained on schedule, ensure that renewable energy standards, solar energy goal, and carbon-free standards are achieved according to the schedules under the necessary laws, and ensure compliance with state environmental policy as stated in the relevant section of law. We balance all of these goals with affordability and reliability of the system, while RUD provides a necessary and singular focus on the impacts to residential and small business customers. And it's through this tension that we push and pull the regulatory process to find and balance on the right solution. Eliminating RUD would not result in a reduced regulatory burden or improve the outcome of the regulatory process because these entities are separate and distinct. Much of the work done by RUD and the department in rate cases and other dockets is not duplicative and would simply be additive to the department's workload or go unaddressed to the detriment of ratepayers if RUD was eliminated. In rate cases, generally, RUD offers testimony on topics the department does not or rarely provides testimony on. These include, as already mentioned, expenses around dues and membership, lobbying expenses, employee travel expenses, employee awards, gifts, investor relation expenses, charitable contributions, and rate case expenses. If RUD is eliminated, it's possible that there would be an increase in intervention and an increase in compensation to fill the void where they normally intervene. And these parties would seek intervener compensation, which would essentially increase rates. Thank you. We're here and available for questions.
Thank you, Sydney Lieb. With that, I want to encourage brevity here, members. We're going to get to a vote within about 10 minutes here. With that, member discussion. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions and then a comment. Why in our packet do we have some of the information that was posted online and not all of it?
The handout, I just found out the handouts were provided this morning. They were scanned in and put in later. Representative Kraft.
The handouts were provided this morning. Okay, well, you look, online, there's a file of testimony, and there are these two things here which we've shown to have inaccuracies in them, and there are two letters from organizations whose sole purpose is to defend the rights of ratepayers and low-income individuals, and we don't have them. So this is biased at best. All right, next question. Representative Kreisha.
Mr. Chair, could I address that?
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. And Representative Kraft, So that was not intentional. We tried to get the handouts as best we could. The allegation that there's inaccuracies, we're still disputing what's out there. So let's not jump to any conclusions on biasness and all that. This is just simply trying to catch up in a very fast environment. The information's online, which I believe we all have access to. So I understand your point, and I'm apologizing for you not having that material, but let's not jump to some type of false representation of what it is.
Representative Kraft, to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, fair point. It has the appearance of bias. Representative Crenshaw, are you willing to give up the $11 million of savings that the RUD office has gotten for ratepayers in exchange for a small amount of a far less amount of tax relief?
Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your question. Appreciate the question. I think the real answer that I provide is, are we willing to allow duplicity when we don't need it? I'm trying to find, I'm not even actually trying to cut the budgets. I'm just trying to find more resources for the AG's office, who we have heard have a very large docket of things that they're investigating. We're doing the same job twice. I think that $11 million could have been found if we had one person or one agency doing that. But we're just simply trying to remove duplicity and trying to get more available resources to handle the very large problem that we have in front of us. So, I mean, we can try to characterize that $11 million all you want. I think it could have been found if we didn't have this duplicity. We don't know that.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Chair Davis. Well, you think so. I appreciate that, Representative Crenshaw. But the Attorney General sitting right to your right is saying no. The experts in this area, the organizations that deal with this, are saying no. And I look at this and I see, I see organization Energy Sense, whose mission is to protect energy access for Minnesotans with low incomes. And I see Citizens Utility Board, who is a nonprofit advocate for our state's utility consumers. I see the folks that are advocating for lower rates for people being very against this bill. And then I see what we're doing here is we're having less oversight on our utilities. And so my question, my concern is that what is happening here is we're sacrificing those ratepayers and people that can afford at least to have less oversight on folks that on large companies' monopolies. And so I am strongly against this bill, just listening to the people that really understand this area.
I didn't hear a question in there, but Representative Crenshaw.
I'm going to have my testifier answer that if I could.
Very quickly, please.
I will. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kraft, I think that, with respect to the $11 million, I'm not sure that we can credit, you know, the Attorney General for all of that. Again, it's the Department of Commerce that's involved in it. There are interveners that you're talking about. Energy Sense would be one example of those kinds of folks that look for these kinds of expenses. The Court of Administrative Hearings is also doing a close review. And six analysts, or actually I think it's 15 analysts from the Public Utilities Commission. And with respect, the organizational dues that they're talking about, the employee expenses, the travel, those are, I don't think, as important to your constituents as $9 billion worth of fraud. It's true, we might have to give up something, but that's what this committee is for, to make those kinds of priorities. What's more important, the $9 billion in fraud or the association expenses that Xcel gives Judy for her retirement party?
Thank you, Mr. Lippman. And before we go to Representative Freiberg, I will remind the committee that we are going to be taking a roll call vote on this at 9:50 a.m. Representative Freiberg. Representative Freiberg.
I think Representative Kraft might have had a follow-up.
Very briefly, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Chair Davis and Representative Freiberg. This is, you're creating a false choice. We have to address fraud, and we should be protecting our ratepayers, and we can absolutely do both. So I reject this false choice.
Representative Freiberg, quickly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, just a comment. I heard that we're, the authors say we're doing the same job twice, but we heard from testifiers that they there's very different goals and objectives between the Department of Commerce and the Attorney General's office. So I kind of reject that notion. I mean, I find it telling, generally speaking, that, you know, we heard from experts in this area that are opposed to this bill. The only testifier in Judge Littman, you and I worked together when you were with the Office of Administrative Hearings. I enjoyed working with you on that.
Indeed.
I don't know anything about your current organization, Utility Reform Now. I mean, you do have some glossy handouts here, setting aside the accuracy of what's on them, but I just find it telling that I'm not really detecting a groundswell of support for this legislation. I think the statute that it changes serves an important consumer protection role, and this is a pretty easy no vote for me.
Co-Vice Chair Bonner.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, in terms of the duplicity or whatnot, I just want to say that when you have a literal David versus Goliath situation, and while all of the support staff are helpful, you know, if you're in a ring and you have all the trainers outside, they all contribute, certainly, but you got to have somebody in the ring to fight for you. The AG is that person. And I'm going to tell you why that's important. What most people do not know is that my uncle, Lloyd St. Peter Peterson, managed to start the Bakers Union and run a successful bakery for 30 years. But what's important to this committee is what he did when he retired. When he retired, he came to this capital and he fought for the things that mattered to him, including making sure that folks didn't pollute the mighty Mississippi. But more importantly, he found out that on his way to church, as he devoted his retirement age to the church, God, and civic duty, he found out that folks in the neighborhood just a short walk away from his house were paying more for their electricity than he was. So he said, in a good old school dignity and honor Republican way, he was going to the Capitol and he was going to fight for the little guy. This is before the RUD existed, mind you. He came to this Capitol because he thought it was wrong that somebody should pay a different rate on their electric bill depending on what neighborhood they lived in.
Vice Chair Bonner, please, to your question.
I'm getting to the point. Thank you. And I think the point of that story is that it takes a little guy to stand up and say, this needs to happen. Somebody has to have a fighter in the ring. The AG is the people's lawyer. He is literally the fighter in the ring fighting for each of us. And so I think it is really irresponsible to say, we're just going to get rid of the people's lawyer and not have anybody to defend them against literally Goliath. So I find this bill to be extremely short-sighted. And for those reasons, I will be a no on this vote today.
Representative Joy.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Kreischer, for this bill. You know, the Attorney General spoke a lot of different things. We talk about inaccuracy, and we talk about saving $11 million. Minnesota's at 16 to 17 cents per kilowatt right now. North Dakota's at 8 to 11 cents. The U.S. average is 13 to 17. I'm glad we got the $11 million savings because we're the highest anyway. You know, the Attorney General needs to be focusing on fraud, not playing into the utilities. $9 billion in fraud, what we heard today. This is what happens when half of the administration pushes a 2040 energy bill. We have rates of 16 to 17 cents. I'm sorry, people can't pay their utilities today. Defending it isn't going to drop that rate. It's policies down here in St. Paul, and that's what needs to change. We attack CEOs, we attack CFOs because of the money they're making and pass on to the ratepayers, but we're not attacking the Democrats that passed the 2040 bill. That changes the rates. That has to put all this infrastructure in, this green energy, building a highway from Fargo, North Dakota. Interstate 94 is going to go to 8 lanes. To build it to Moorhead is going to cost us $25 million in gas mitigation just to build another lane. We're not attacking that. We're talking about let's go after the CEOs, the successful people. That's what we need to change. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we just had a release of another audit where DHS needed the AG's assistance with fraud and kickbacks. And it's past time that we had further and fuller engagement of the AG's office with the hundreds of millions in different programs.
Chair Cleavorn to close out comments.
Thank you very much. And Attorney General, I'd like to say thank you to your office and to the RUD for the $11 million in savings that is a direct result of your work. So I want to say thank you for the hard work of the people of your office. And I see Commerce shaking their head in agreement with that statement. I find that the entire conversation is so interesting today that once again, we are hearing that protection of CEO salary, CEO travel expense, CEO perks and benefits are above the residential ratepayer and small businesses. That's not the argument I thought we would be hearing today in this committee on this bill. I am a no vote on the bill. I would encourage my side also to be a no vote. The entities perform two separate services, have two separate statutory goals. This is not duplicative. It is equal importance of Commerce and the Attorney General's office. Members on our side, I'm really glad a roll call has been requested, and I ask for a no vote on our side. This bill is not a good bill for small business. This is not a good bill for the ratepayers. Thank you.
With that, the CLA will take the roll.
Chair Nash.
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, no.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, aye.
Representative Clardy.
No.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Jones.
Jones, no.
Representative Joy.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick. Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
No.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Sexton.
Yes. There being seven ayes and seven nays, the bill does not pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
And Mr. Chair, can I get a 1 minute close? I did not get that. If I don't have time, that's fine. 30 seconds.
10 seconds as Chair Torkelson's coming up.
All I want to say is, members, thank you very much. Please read the bill. It is about duplicate services, and we're looking at how we can save some efficiency. It's really not about CEOs and all that. That was not what's in this bill, and I would encourage you to read that. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Representative Kreisha. Now before us, members, we're going to move quickly. House File 4259 is before us. Chair Torkelson, welcome to the committee. Chair Torkelson, your bill is before us, and we, I believe, are making a motion to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Chair Torkelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr.
And
Chair.
And if we could get the audience to quiet, thank you so much.
And Co-Chair Claiborne for hearing this bill today. House File 4259 is actually a very simple bill. It raises the number of members of the Minnesota House from 134 to 135. And reduces the number of members of the Minnesota Senate from 67 to 45. Why on earth would we do this? The fact is the Minnesota House has been tied twice since it was reduced from 135 to 134 in the early 70s. And both times we very nearly had a crisis. In 1979, they met for the first year of the biennium, and near the end of that year, a member of the House was removed. As you may know, when you're accused by the House of you cannot vote on your own outcome. That thereby creates a 67-66 situation, and someone can be removed from the body. That happened in 1979, and then there was a special election. Democrats took over the majority after that special election. Last year, as you know, we came in with a tie, and we had a very difficult time even starting the session. Half of the House refused to show up for work. A long, difficult period of negotiations ensued, and we finally then, after reaching agreement, did get to work, really damaging the reputation of the House and putting us, if that had gone on longer, could have actually made it impossible to get our work done. So where does Minnesota sit in relation to the other states in the country? The Minnesota Senate at 67 members is the largest Senate of all 50 states in the country. The largest, by quite a margin. If we reduced our membership of the Senate to 45, we would actually be, I believe, the 12th largest state, I'm sorry, the 16th largest Senate in the country. Still in the top third, still a significant number, and by raising the number of members of the House from 134 to 135, our rank would not change at all. We would stay 12th largest in the country. You may think, well, what are other states doing? In Wisconsin, our neighbor of comparable size, they have 99 members of the House and 33 members of the Senate. Still, we would be quite a bit larger than Wisconsin, a state that's very comparable to us in size of population. California, we would have 81 more, we currently have 81 more members than the state of California, even though the state of California has 7 times the population of the state of Minnesota. We are 14th by land area. We rank 14th by land area, but yet we rank 11th in size. This has been attempted before. In 2018, Representative Zerwas and Senator Jensen actually proposed reducing the number from down to 147 total, 49 in the Senate, 98 in the House. So why the number that I'm proposing, 135? And 45. Well, in the Constitution, it says that the representation in both houses must be apportioned equally throughout the state. We know that. That was required by the federal courts. Senators must be chosen by single districts of convenient contiguous territory numbered in regular series, and that's simple enough. No representative district may be divided in the formation of a Senate district. So we either have 2 House districts in 1 Senate district, or in the case of my proposal, we would go to 3 House districts in 1 Senate district. This number of 135 and 45 is really, if you kind of go through the math, if you're going to have an uneven number of members in the House, it really comes closest to what working with this 135-45 split. Actually, we have 135 desks on the House floor, so there's no requirement there. And finally, to the financial aspects of this, we would save a considerable amount of money. I don't have a fiscal note, but it's not hard to figure out that by eliminating a significant number of senators, we would save a significant amount of money. This bill is being laid over at this point. I have shared this idea with some senators and had a Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, can't you control your committee? That was an outburst.
I think it was all sharing the joy at potentially seeing less senators roam our halls, maybe. I'll just interpret it as that.
Well, thank you.
But thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you done with your presentation? We have limited time.
I can be done. I know you're short of time. I could go on. I could go on into all the history of the state of Minnesota and the size of the legislature over the years. It's changed quite a few times in Minnesota history. We had 135 members for quite a while, so it's not really that far out of bounds, so to speak. But, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to stop there and take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Cleburne, are you making the sole close up for...
Due to time, since we have 1 minute, I will make the closing, if that's all right with my side. Okay. So thank you, Chair Torgelson, for bringing this bill forward. I appreciated our work together on redistricting, and I believe you have best intent of the House in mind. I do want to make a couple of corrections. One, half of the House did not refuse to show up. Half of the House was supporting the vote of the voters. The other thing I would like to say about the bill is I am concerned about dilution of voter representation in the Senate if you were to go to 35 senators. they would have a much larger workload, and therefore they would have less representation per individual. But I appreciate what you're trying to do is fix the tie in the House. So with that, I'm glad it's being laid over, and I know there's no Senate companion. One last statement I need to make for the committee. We have a member that was participating on the last bill remotely, asked to speak, did not get an opportunity to speak. So as we go forward, I ask that remote members please be recognized. Thank you, Chair Torkelson, for the bill.
And Chair Torkelson, Chair. I will say I myself have served in the majority, the minority, and I have dubbed this the tiority. And this has been more difficult than the others. So I appreciate the effort in the bill and will give you last word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in response to Chair Claiborne, whatever the reason the House didn't get started in business, the fact is it didn't get started. There were weeks of time where we should have been meeting where we were not. We can disagree on why that happened, but the fact is it did happen.
Just let's not impugn motive. That's all I ask.
Madam Chair, I am the chair today, so we'll go with speaking through the chair at all times.
And secondly, as far as the number of members, number of constituents represented by a senator, I don't have that exact statistic ahead of me, but there are many states across the country, even with this change, that have many more constituents represented by a single senator. I would hold out California as an outstanding example of a very large number of constituents. But even next door in Wisconsin, a state very similar in size to us as far as population goes, they only have 33 senators, and I'm proposing 45.
And we are past time. And with that, members, the bill is laid over. Thank you, Chair Torkelson, and we are adjourned.